Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. What if the next great chapter for Canadian agriculture isn't just about what we grow, but what we build from it? We talk a lot on this show about the pressures facing the agri-food sector. Trade disruptions, climate volatility, supply chain fragility. And those are real. But every once in a while, a conversation comes along that reframes the entire picture. That shifts you from managing risk to seeing genuine generational opportunity. And today's conversation is one of those. My guest is John Rafferty, the president and CEO of Ontario Genomics. When most of us hear the word genomics, our eyes probably glaze over a little. It sounds like something happening far away, in a lab, by nerds in white coats. Not something that touches a farmer's bottom line or a rural community's future. But John changes that. What Ontario Genomics is working towards is something called biomanufacturing. The idea that we can take agricultural inputs, like corn, dairy byproducts, biomass, and instead of shipping them out or processing them the way we always have, we can ferment them, transform them, manufacture everything from bioplastics to food colorants to proteins. Circular, renewable, and rooted right here in Canada's soil. John came to this sector not as a scientist, but as a leader. He's reinvented himself across financial services, telecom, and the charitable sector. And now he's asking a question that I think every person in this industry should be contemplating themselves. Canada has the land, the water, the clean energy, and the talent. So what's stopping us from becoming a superpower? Yes, we often brag about our agricultural muscle. But what about advanced biomanufacturing? Taking that agricultural foundation and upgrading it, not just for the global market, but for an entirely new, sustainable, circular civilization. Sounds a little crazy, but entirely grounded in contemporary science. And that's where we focus today's conversation. All right, let's hit it. John, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I like to start every episode with a kind of ritual. It's sort of an abstract question I like to throw to our guests. There's no wrong answer. And it's, what does the future mean to you?
Wow. It's always a challenging question. I knew you were going to ask it as well. I think the future has a number of things. For me, the future is about hope. The future is about unity. I think the future is about sustainability, respect. I think there are things that we've lost from society, and there are things that kind of as human race evolves and we accelerate that maybe we've gone two or three steps further and need a step back every once in a while. And I think that we're approaching a kind of a bit of a place of reflection where I think that would be a good thing to do.
Right on. Very powerful. Now, part of the reason, of course, we wanted to have you on the show is to dig into genomics and not just the kind of broader genre, but in particular, the exciting role that it is currently playing and will play within the agri-food sector. But a natural follow-up to kind of get into the category of origin stories is how did you get involved in agriculture, in agri-food? And I ask that because you do have quite a diverse experience, both in terms of leadership, but also in terms of different sectors. And, you know, genomics yes. In particular is not necessarily a place for beginners. I'm curious what drew you to the sector in general and genomics in particular.
So this is, I guess, John version 4 or kind of reinvention or reincarnation 4.0. In terms of careers, I started in what would be called financial services, and then I spent a time within the telecom organizations. Then I ran a very large, one of Canada's largest and oldest charities. And leaving there, having been there for almost 16 years in the end, or actually a little over 16, I wanted something that would kind of bring startup entrepreneurship with my business leadership and my experience working from a policy and a government regulations perspective. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. You can ask me lots of things about genomics, and I've got a very good broad knowledge. We're on the verge of needing to commercialize a lot of what genomics has been producing over the last 25 years. And while as an organization, Ontario Genomics is now, with our new strategic plan, said we actually have two quite distinct missions. One is in the world of precision health, the human side of rare diseases and diagnostics and therapeutics. And the other is in food and industrial biotech. It's in the way in which we can stop being an extraction-based society from a manufacturing, stop extracting from the earth, and start doing things in a circular way, start biomanufacturing. And a lot of research says that 60% of everything that humans consume can be biomanufactured. And if its origin is from agriculture, a biomass input, then it can then, on a circular basis, go back into the earth as well. And that kind of circular economy, you know, I'm not a closet environmentalist. I'm an environmentalist. I believe very fundamentally that we need to focus on creating a healthy planet moving forward. And shifting from extraction-based manufacturing to circular manufacturing is, I think, a huge opportunity.
So go ahead, Jen.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, John. I guess the first question I want to bring back to farmers, and when we talk about genomics, it can be kind of a an unknown, mm-hmm. which has the potential then to be a bit scary. So why should farmers care about genomics as part of their business?
So I think that there are two places where genomics plays a role. It plays a role within traditional elements of farming. So as our climate changes, as the profile of that changes, the risk profile of pests, the risk profile of droughts, you know, there are things that are that we're funding as an organization, research projects that are looking at how to make crops more frost resistant, how to make crops more drought resistant, how to help with milk production levels in dairy herds. So there is this traditional genomics world that has had lots of breakthroughs that farmers would be quite familiar with. And there are more to come, you know, and I think looking really going down to the microbial health of soil, which is fundamental to all farmers, whatever farming you're doing, and understanding the genomics of soil and all of the microbes that are in it is a really, really fundamental piece. So that's why farmers should be interested on that side. I think what genomics is also presenting now is the ability for us to take a biomass input, whether it's lactose off of dairy or acid whey from dairy production, whether it's things as fundamental as corn or other inputs from grain growers, and we can biomanufacture, we can ferment using yeasts usually. We're using the biomass as a form of sugar in that sense of fermenting to produce almost anything we want, from bioplastics to bionylons to food colorants to proteins, not to compete with agriculture, because that's not what it does. It's to complement And I think there's a huge opportunity in Canada for our farming community to understand how can they diversify revenue streams, how can they, you know, create more value per acre by us being able to explore the biomanufacturing elements of fermentation. And we've done it in our past with kind of fundamentals like ethanol, but we can do it in so many more ways because of genomics now.
Well, Ed, you were suggesting that on some levels you're not competing with agriculture, but allow me to tease out the kind of assertion of a circular economy. To what extent are we creating alternatives to the petroleum industry, to plastics, to, you know, some of the more extractive industries that I think we do want to be, at least speaking for myself, reducing our reliance upon? I'd love for you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, so, I mean, absolutely. I think that this is all, you know, complementary to the agricultural and additive to the agricultural industry. I suppose if it's competitive, it's competitive with petroleum. That's a finite resource. I think that it would take decades and decades for that to be viewed by the petroleum industry as something that's competitive. But we need to stop extracting, and wherever we can replace petroleum with a biomass input, which is circular in its nature, then we have an obligation, I think, to explore that. Ultimately, commercial markets work on a cost per unit. A lot of the things we're talking about, just like they are in all elements of the farming world, are commodities that have a price, and they have input costs and production costs, and biomanufacturing is no different. And we're up against competing with what has been, you know, 100 years worth of developing and perfecting the economics of petroleum-based manufacturing of product. So it's not going to be an overnight, just like it wasn't an overnight to create solar energy or wind energy. The cost per unit initially of creating energy that way was huge factor over that of traditional methods. Now it's a very competitive industry, and we're starting to see an acceleration of movement away from electricity production involving finite resources and into renewable. And I think hopefully the same will be the case for all of our nylons and polyesters and our plastics that we currently make using petroleum.
Well, and that kind of nicely circles back to your earlier point about the not just focus, but I suppose challenge around commercialization. That, you know, commercialization is obviously a key component of enabling this kind of advanced manufacturing. But it has historically also been something that Canada and Ontario in particular has a mixed track record on. So what are some of the challenges? What are some of the opportunities? What are some of the things that Ontario Genomics in particular kind of sees as game changing when it comes to improving the kind of commercialization that is required to enable the kind of infrastructure and industry that you're describing?
Yeah, so we produced the second version of a report called the Food Innovation Report in 2025. It was launched at the end of March 2025, and it speaks broadly to innovations across the sector, and it calls out two things that are needed in Ontario and across Canada, and that is the ability for companies that are creating these technologies to be able to scale in a meaningful way, and the ability for regulators to keep up with novel ingredients, in a way that makes sure that our regulatory framework isn't getting in the way of innovation. And regulations are there for a reason, and I'm not saying we need to get rid of all regulations, I'm just saying we need to make sure that they don't become an undue barrier to innovation. The initial controllable piece of that is the ability to scale. I referred a little while ago to the fact that we have two missions. Within the precision health world, they're discovering molecules for a therapeutic that have a huge value per microgram, right? That scaling in that kind of very intense and precise way is, you know, people want to produce hundreds of grams of something. If you're producing a sweetener using, input from a grain grower, you're competing against sugar, which has a spot market of whatever it is at the moment. It's about $1 Canadian per kilogram. So if you're producing that, you need to produce hundreds of kilograms for sampling, not hundreds of grams. So the need that we have in Canada writ large, there are a few pockets where we do have this, but in Ontario we don't, is the ability for our innovators and startup companies to be able to move up the progression of scale so that they're producing hundreds of kilograms and can start demonstrating their unit economics. Because at the end of the day, if you're a food manufacturer and you're interested in one of these biomanufactured products, it's still got to compete on price with what you currently have. We can wax poetic about how important it is to have something that's circular economy based versus extraction based, but it's still got to compete on price. And that's kind of a real challenge that we're currently working to try and solve.
So John, you said something really interesting there. You said in other areas, there is this capacity to have innovators scale up, but not in Ontario. What is the missing piece in Ontario? What's the missing piece is
biomanufacturing capacity at 1,000 liters that is accessible and priced appropriately. At the moment, our startups in Ontario, they need to go to Nova Scotia, or they need to go to Saskatchewan, or they need to go to another country. Ontario is a pretty important part of the Canadian economy. It's got a huge agri-food sector, and we've got a lot of the innovators are based here in Ontario, and so we're looking to solve that particular gap.
And is that a capital issue or is that a regulatory issue?
At the moment, it's a capital issue. The more companies we have that are able to start scaling, then they're going to start putting pressure on the regulators. But the regulatory issues are there in terms of speed and process, but they're not, hugely onerous. It's not a barrier. It's not a missing thing. It just is something that we've got to constantly pay attention to make sure that we don't discount innovative products.
So let me ask you a what may be a digression, but at the same time may bring us also to another way to approach some of these subjects and some of the challenges you're facing. You sort of, when we talk about regulation in general, it tends to be a through line through a lot of conversations in the agri-food sector, partly because I think we are in a moment where we are rethinking regulatory environments. We are rethinking the nature of regulations that apply both to a changing global market, but also a rapid rate of technological change. That's part of the point of genomics is we now have access to technology that I think our current regulatory environment just didn't anticipate. But you've alluded a couple times to the dual mandate that your organization has, that on the one hand, I think precision medicine is where most people engage genomics, is where the idea of genetics, especially around cancer, kind of hits home for people. But obviously, when it comes to food, health and safety is also a factor. Is there an opportunity here to have both sides from a regulatory perspective collaborating so that you can not only be proactive, either in the aspirational sense of self-regulation or just in the sense of leadership of helping the regulatory environment kind of upgrade where you have the people who are experienced in navigating the medical regulatory environment, but also focusing on not doing harm and looking at health effects, compared to the other people who are looking at productivity and prosperity and efficiency and optimization. Is there an opportunity for Ontario Genomics to kind of play both sides of that and create a unique form of expertise, especially when it comes to leading in an area like regulation that can be very contentious?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on there. I think that we need to learn the lessons from both sides of our missions to make sure that we're bringing what we learn on the therapeutic and diagnostic sides of how to get something approved in Canada to the other side of the ledger as well, for Ontario Genomics, other side of the ledger. I think it's anytime anything touches our food, whether it's the packaging that's made by something different, we need to make sure health and safety is really important. And Canada has got a stellar reputation for its standards. As I said, I don't think regulation in and of itself is a challenge, but we need to move at speed. The more things are moving faster, it just creates challenge. In and of itself, it isn't a problem, but speed to market is a thing, and we don't want unnecessary barriers or lags in the way.
So where does complexity fall into that? And sorry to preempt you, Jen, and hopefully you'll jump in. And I say complexity both on the regulatory sense, but really I'm coming back to you as a leader and as a communicator. Because on the one hand, it strikes me that genomics as a science, and certainly within the concept of an applied technology, allows us to engage in greater complexity, allows us to entertain greater complexity. How do you communicate that complexity? To what extent is that complexity just par for the course? Or is it another dynamic to manage, either on the regulatory end or, to your point, on the speed, on the getting things to market, finding ways to scale? I may be imagining that complexity is something that plays a role here, but it just strikes me as being a core element of the environment that we're describing.
So, I think, to your point, that there are complex pieces to this, but our role is to talk about what the outcome that we're looking for is, and to make sure we have clarity on the outcome, which is really simple on the precision health. You talk about, a diagnostic and therapeutic pointing to a particular thing. We know what the North Star is from a patient's perspective. We need to clearly communicate what the North Star is within the biomanufacturing world. I think it's easier and clearer to talk about that on things like bioplastics. The ability for us to eliminate petroleum and the ongoing increase of microplastics in the environment by producing plastics that are biomanufactured, I think has a lot of clarity. Are there complexities in order to make that happen? Yes. Our job is, as we sit as a convener between the amazing people that are the innovators and the kind of the regulators and the markets. And as that convener, as that trusted intermediary, our job is to be clear in why it's important, to clear on what the North Star is. Ideally, we are able to convince policymakers to do a similar thing in some of these areas as they did in the area of electricity production, which is kind of mandating, something as powerful as mandating that by a certain date, X percent of packaging has to be biomanufactured from a not just recyclable, but this is about it being fully biodegradable and how we manage it. But we've also built a whole infrastructure in how we manage waste at a municipal level, which lends itself to different colored bins. And if we're going to change the nature of plastics, then we need to change the nature of how we manage them. because they need to be dealt with differently than a petroleum-based plastic. So there are lots of complexities. But if the North Star is the technology allows it to happen, we're now able to start proving that the unit costs, the cost unit economics is getting close enough to parity that we can now get this across the threshold and make a meaningful change in the way that we biomanufacture versus use extraction manufacturing.
I just want to expand the conversation a little bit because I like what you were talking about, the North Star and getting real clarity on the outcomes. And I think in the health field, it is a lot easier. But when we look at what Ontario Genomics is doing, it's more than just bioplastics. You're also looking at cellular agriculture. And so how do you go about getting a North Star for ag and food when it comes to the Ontario Genomics umbrella?
And that's one of the biggest challenges that we have as a communications exercise, I think, Jen, to your question. We deal with the microbial health of soil. We deal with how we can help microbes in water to help the extraction of rare minerals. We deal with modifications to help protect plants against climate. And so the breadth of what we do is so much. How do you have a single North Star for all of that? Because you start from a communications perspective, you're talking about world peace. You know, you're talking about this nebulous thing that is, while everyone will agree to it, you know, it's not precise enough. So I think we need to define and start getting successes, you know, at a ground level, working with a farmer, a group of farmers, in helping diversify revenues, in helping showing how we can start biomanufacturing products that go into our supply chain that currently we import, that we talk about things that are you know, on the margins currently because of where they come in the world, and us being able to biomanufacture them creates supply chain security. And then we can start taking those victories and scaling them forward. This is not going to be a, you know, one great campaign and everyone knows what we're doing. It is a little bit more complicated than that. And that's because, you know, there's a genome in everything, you know, and all the way down to the microbial level. And it's a very powerful thing. And it is going to be kind of the bio era moving forward. And I know AI is going to fuel a lot of that because effectively the genomic research is kicking out huge amounts of data. And AI is accelerating how quickly we can therefore analyze, interpret, and make sense of all of that data. And everything will go faster as a result.
I want to come back to the AI stuff as well as the microbial stuff. But to build off Jen's question, I think you and I politically, at least certainly environmentally, are kind of eye to eye. And I appreciate that you've been framing a lot of this within the context of our domestic needs in terms of a population who obviously needs to eat and enjoys a very diverse diet that we have to import a lot of. But what about the export potential here? And I say this because I assume that is very much part of the kind of focus of commercialization. And I do think a lot of the agri-food industry really does think of success in the export-oriented concept, right? Like we as an industry really think of it a success within that context. So spell out some of the opportunities. And not just the opportunities, but where does the global market play? Are we leaders? Are we catching up? Who else in the world is kind of developing similar expertise or centers of excellence that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, okay, lots of pieces to that, and hopefully I'll weave in an answer to all of your comments there, Jesse. I think first of all, if you wanted to define and rank by potential the countries in the world that can play a role as an agriculture superpower and therefore a biomanufacturing superpower, you need acreage. We've got a lot of acreage in Canada. You need abundance of water. We've got an abundance of water. You need relatively low cost and clean energy. We have low cost clean energy. Just like we have always been one of the top countries in the world in helping feed the world. I think we have dropped a little bit over the last while as in terms of global agricultural ranking, but we're still, you know, right up there. We have all of the ingredients, no pun intended, to be an agricultural superpower. The question is, do we want to grow crops that we send overseas, or do we want to do something with a portion of what we're growing and expand our acreage so that we're also biomanufacturing products that go overseas? So there is a huge global market for us to be able to be a biomanufacturing superpower as well as an agriculture superpower. And I think those two things, in my opinion, are the same. I think that there is a distinction between them, but they're both using the natural resources of Canada in a circular way to help provide food and ingredients for the world. Now, the countries who are doing it best are countries that are starved for land mass, because they have to be more efficient, more effective with every acre they have. You know, the Netherlands, comes to mind. Singapore, some of the other Asian countries come to mind. You know, I think that we do things very well, but we've got a very traditional agricultural export market in terms of what goes where. And we've also been very, very intertwined with the US. And I'm not an international trade expert, but I, you know, those relationships have been broken with the US. There is a huge opportunity for us to expand elsewhere. Having said that, the US will always be the biggest market, you know, on our doorstep. And therefore, we also need to take advantage of that market as well. We have a lot of what they need. So it's a huge export opportunity. It's a huge global opportunity. And biomanufacturing, you know, the jobs that come in in scaled biomanufacturing, they kind of look like jobs that are in an automotive plant in many ways. You know, like these are, you know, there are thousands and thousands of jobs that can be created in Ontario in the biomanufacturing sector. And I think that those are some of the jobs of the future.
Right on. And that actually allows me to kind of ask the AI question, kind of building off the answers you've been giving in terms of building an ecosystem, building a culture of commercialization, of scale, of focusing on export-oriented markets. I mean, obviously, one of the strongest assets that we have here in Ontario are our post-secondary institutions, right? Whether it's Guelph, Kitchener-Waterloo, yeah. Toronto. I mean, we have some of the best and brightest minds in the world. But on the commercialization level, to your point about the United States, we are often heavily reliant upon their technology industry. What role is Ontario Genomics trying to play when it comes to the AI side? And I don't mean so much the technology angle, I mean the commercialization angle. I mean kind of taking the phenomenal research that is happening at our universities and weaving it into the industry, or to your earlier evocation, allowing entrepreneurs to create new companies and scale up those companies. What's the business angle of the technology piece, or even if you want the policy or regulatory angle, because I suspect they are also factors? Yeah, kind of help me understand, to your point, not just the role that AI is playing, but that what we need it to play in terms of the threads of our conversation that you've so eloquently been bringing up.
Well, I think there are a couple of points that you bring up there. So AI, there isn't a project that we're helping fund or a company that we provide funding to that isn't using AI within its work. You know, some more overtly than others, but it is a part of how we accelerate the discovery and the learnings, whether it's at you know, within the lab discovery side, or whether it's in the process engineering side of understanding how we can be more effective and more efficient to drive unit costs to where they need to be. So AI is a huge piece. One of the factors in North America that is a truism that that will not go away is that the US market is 11 times bigger than the Canadian market. If you have a new company here in Canada and you are going to spend some money to get something approved for a market, you can choose to do that and get it approved in Canada, or you can choose to do that in America. And America is 11 times bigger. It's not that, you know, there is just an economies of scale. And one of the challenges, and I've been Canadian since the late 1980s. I came as a landed immigrant in 1986. And the reason I'm saying that is because whenever I say anything that's at all critical of Canada, I feel that my accent makes it things like I'm a foreigner, you know, making a comment, and I'm not. But, you know, Canada, if you took not just our landmass, but if you took our economy and you dropped it somewhere else in the world, if you dropped it in Europe, it would be this really important economy within the European Union. If you dropped it over, you know, off the coast of Australia, it would be a bigger economy than Australia. It would be a powerhouse in that kind of Southeast Asia. But because we sit on top of the biggest economy in the world, we almost have a bit of a self-conscious, we're not really that big an economy. We're a huge economy. We've got a great market, and but we have the challenge of proximity to the biggest market in the world. And I think that plays into things, into the dynamics of where companies go and how do we keep them in Canada when you've got this much bigger market just a short way away. Ontario Genomics plays a role with wraparound support for the companies we provide funding with, you know, providing access to an introduction to people in the VC world, in the venture funding world. I think some of the work we're doing in our intake process and our wraparound support is done in a way to help de-risk people investing. And I think our BioCreate brand in particular is building a reputation because of the amazing work that the companies we funded have done. I think people are seeing that as if Ontario Genomics has provided funding through BioCreate, I think that maybe that's someone we should look at. So hopefully over time, we can play a role in that kind of de-risking, profiling the amazing Canadian startups that we have.
I'm going to ask you a question that's going to take us off the AI topic for a moment, but then I think I want to come back because I have an AI question. But first off, can you talk a little bit about that BioCreate program, please?
Sure. BioCreate is a program that we launched 4 years ago. We provide $150,000 worth of non-dilutive funding to companies that are post-discovery. At that kind of inflection point, they're generally pre-revenue, but their product has been validated as strong, and it's pointing at a market that has value. So we don't just write a check and provide it to them, and the funding comes from a combination of the federal and provincial government through FedDev in Ontario, as well as MCures provincially. And then we provide 18 months worth of wraparound support, it's a requirement for the funding that people participate in it. It just is got a lot of special sauce to it when you bring those entrepreneurs together. So we've got 32 companies now, some of which we just funded. So if you look at the first 16 that we funded, they've raised $98 million worth of follow-on funding now. So, you know, there's some real winners there. Half of those companies are in the food, industrial, biotech, ag space. So half are in the food ag space, the other half are in the precision health space. So,
go Go ahead, Jen. You had an.
Sorry, Jesse and I think are fighting over who asked
the
next question.
You reserved the spot with your AI question. Please go ahead.
Yeah. So I have a bit of a philosophical AI question, and it's something that I'm just learning more and more about AI. But one of the hesitations I hear from people, or you know, I've been reading about, is the environmental impact of AI. Yeah. And so we're using AI to build a circular economy, and yet AI is also draining resources. How do we reconcile those two positions?
Yeah, I think I feel the same way about the environmental footprint of AI. And, you know, whether you, and I also not sure because of AI, which data points to believe or trust more than others. But, you know, the amount of trillions of requests or questions that are being asked in the AI world, each of which takes this much water, a very tiny amount, but it adds up the water consumption, the power consumption, the land use. It's pretty scary. And how much of it is actually being used for things that are enabling, you know, humanity versus creating a different circular challenge, not a circular economy, but just circularity of information and misinformation. So I think societies are starting to think about how do we keep and capture all the things that could be good coming out of AI, and how do we find a way of partitioning off and discarding the rest? And I think we're gonna have some significant challenges along the way where it's going to go off the rails on some things, but humanity finds ways to rein that in. Sometimes it's after something terrible has happened that allows us to realize that. Hopefully we can avoid that type of a thing. But I think that within closed data sets, like genomic data, you know, looking at how we can come up with a new therapeutic for a particular disease, that needs to be enhanced and needs to be used. There's value in how AI can accelerate that discovery. But in other areas, we've got to recognize the environmental footprint of AI itself and what things just don't justify the negative environmental impact. So it's challenging because I agree we're speaking out both sides of our mouth when we say AI is doing these amazing things to help us create a better circular economy, but what's the environmental impact of the AI that we're using? So,
and you know, your answers today have been fantastic, both in terms of to that last point, acknowledging the nuance and complexity of a lot of these situations, while still having the optimism, the hope to see a better future. That permits me to throw an even more advanced, contentious question your way. Intellectual property obviously plays a key role both on the commercialization side, but also on the research side. You know, while AI is often criticized in terms of the copyright elements in terms of training, you know, putting that stuff aside, what about the reverse engineering side of AI? And I say this because I think we're still trying to wrap our heads, especially some of the latest frontier models like Anthropic's Mythos. To what extent does the intellectual property elements, does the intellectual property protection in the environment, both of capital funding and of regulation, how does that become complicated? How do some of the communities that you're involved in, the companies that they're starting, do they worry about this stuff? Do they worry about protecting their intellectual property? And again, from a sectoral perspective, from Ontario or a Canada perspective, how do we be proactive? How do we anticipate that? How do we, on the one hand, enable the kind of research collaboration that we have that is required, while on the same time anticipating the intellectual property challenges and the competitive advantages that any advanced technology like this would encounter?
So you're asking, it's a huge philosophical question that's in there as well. And I think we can, from 6 years ago, point to a galvanizing issue that was global in its nature in COVID-19, and the need for us to use genomic research and researchers around the world to say we need a vaccine. And I think that we know when we have to, we can. It's a shame that we can't just say, hey, that works really well. Why don't we do that for lots of other human issues that we face? But we don't. We get these protectionist market-based views of how do I create more value for me? You use the word open source. You're going to make me want to start talking about Star Trek and kind of the ultimate kind of what do we want to create as a society of humans globally. And we're a long way from that. But, you know, we do need to find a landing place for how AI moves forward in a way that is a tool that humans use and is enabling more humanity versus some sort of a combative anti-human tool that's going to take jobs and, you know, anyway. So you there are lots of camps on it. I don't pretend to be an AI expert. I'm sure I hear many of the things you do, but probably not as many. But I think that you've got CEOs of the large, you know, mega corporations are either going to approach this as a way of eliminating jobs and driving more money into their pocket, or as a tool that's going to allow them to grow employment and equality for the people who work for them. There was, I think it was Walmart CEO that made a quote about that, you know, that this is going to enable them to employ more people versus other companies that say this is going to allow them to cut jobs. It has the potential to be equal parts good or bad. Let's keep the good and throw the bad away. It's an oversimple way of saying it, but
now we are getting close to the end of time. I have a few more questions. Yeah. I want to ask. This is me also probing Jen to jump in if she has more questions to ask. I've been wanting to come back to the microbial piece only because it is an area of interest to mine, because I do find it fascinating. To what extent, and this is me coming back to the literacy piece and kind of your role as a leader, kind of communicating these issues to other leaders, to society as a whole, to what extent is genomic literacy and microbial literacy connected? And I say this because both are obviously a lot smaller than us. And I think certainly in my lifetime, we're getting to a point where we're starting to value those tiny things. We're starting to recognize that there are systems that we can't immediately scrutinize that are incredibly powerful, incredibly impactful. Yeah. Do me a favor and help me try to connect these two and whether you see a connection in terms of fostering the awareness, especially amongst decision makers, as to why the work that you guys are doing at Ontario Genomics is so important, both near term, but more importantly, also to, as you've been evoking throughout our conversation, towards the long term.
Yeah, I think so. First of all, the word genomics for 99% of people kind of makes them glassy eyed and, you know, not want to listen to the rest of your sentence. So which is a challenge. And those three of us and others who have dug into and know, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm not saying this from that perspective, but understand the power of knowledge that we can get through the use of genomics and therefore turn that into action that is powerful and positive. I mean, we have known in our history that we don't want to plant the same crop in the same field 2 years in a row, and if we rotate them effectively, that so we've had this kind of innate knowledge of how we create healthy soil. How can we make that more precise over time? I think some of the fundamentals are and always will be there. But the power at the microbial level is incredibly important. And whether it's the health of the soil or whether it's the ability for us to kind of do bioremediation work in other areas, whether it's about, you know, recognizing new pathogens, new threats for disease that are coming into the soil. So, you know, I think the, you know, we care at Ontario Genomics, we care about the molecule, and not many people do. And so it is a difficult narrative to break through. I'm a convert because, you know, I came into this world 15 months ago, and every day I learn more. I'm blessed to have an amazing team of people who truly understand it. And I think that the, you know, what we learned from, you know, from COVID is what will kill us or make us healthy is going to be a molecule somewhere. And so we need to understand it. So I think, I think the future is very bright when it comes to turning the corner on putting the importance of soil health and microbial health there. I think it's important at a human level. We talk a lot more now about our gut health and our microbial health. So that narrative's happening. It will become kind of more ubiquitous. I think that 20 years ago, genomics was a really specialized field. Now it is almost a part of everything. You know, there isn't, it was a thing and now it's a part of everything. And I think that's a good thing. So we maybe need to speak about it less and just do it more.
Well, and if anything, to kind of validate your role, I think part of the reason there is a legacy of people thinking that the molecular is boring is because there haven't been enough outsiders brought in to become part of the ecosystem, to become insiders, to become communicators. Mm-hmm. So that, if anything, mm-hmm. speaks to more people like yourself engaged. You know, very briefly, because we are almost out of time. You know, the second last question I like to ask people is, you know, if you had organizationally all the resources you could have, if you had access to the right people in power, what would be the kind of policies? What would be the kind of broad frameworks, or even, you know, kind of broad regulations that in a kind of blue sky scenario would really make a difference for not just Ontario, but the Canadian genomics industry?
Yeah, I think that we would have a network across the country of bioscaling facilities for people that are discovering. We would be talking to and listening more to industry and to farmers. So the two ends of the equation, we sit in the middle, talking about what problems need to be solved. And hopefully we're having more and more dialogue as an organization with both those sides. So we create challenges of things that we need to solve together. Whenever humans are faced with a challenge to solve, and you bring people into a table saying, we want to solve this, and I, you know, whether it's a food ingredient that we are 100% of an importer for, that we can start building our own capacity for and therefore de-risk supply chains, whether it's something like plastics or nylons where we currently, the process is petroleum-based and extraction-based and we can turn it into circular, or whether it's something that's a chemical additive, something that has hugely negative impacts. We've seen a recent transformation in the area of food colorants. you know, the future of food colorants is biomanufactured. We have a great Ontario-based company that does that, that we funded through BioCreate. And so looking at a challenge-based way to solve it, if we had the resources and ability to do that, we would also at the policy level have some things that would mandate targets and dates, similar to things that we've done on the power generation electricity side, that by this date, X percent of these chemicals will be eliminated from food production, that, you know, that food colorants will be eliminated, that that all food packaging will be bioplastics. So the things that we would do would move a lot faster if we had the resources.
Right on. Jen, any final questions? So the last question that I tend to end on, it's kind of like the first. It's meant to be intuitive, kind of gut response. But who are the people that you look up to? Who are the people that you follow? Could be living, could be dead, that you think the rest of us should be tuning into?
So I have a lot of places. I'm going to start with someone who's dead and not necessarily a person I look up to, but kind of philosophically, Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem titled If. And I think if we had more people that adhered, it's written in a male gender, but put it into a neutral gender, because it was written 100 years ago now. If all of us spoke to each other the right way, if we cared about each other the right way, and if we put 60 seconds worth of effort into every minute, so philosophically, I think that would land us in a great place. I feel that we need to talk more, we need to engage in conversation more. I have spent a lot of time trying to increase my knowledge into the farming world, from the Ottawa Valley, which is a real bed of farming communities. We've got such an amazing network of 100-acre farmers in Ontario. Yes, we've got large farmers as well, but that kind of 100-acre plot, whether it's dairy or beef, or whether it's mixed use or grain, I think that's just something we need to tap into more. And I'm looking forward to this learning journey, this kind of phase four of my journey. Hopefully I can become a really good storyteller in this area and therefore bring policymakers along, bring the funding that we need along. We don't need as an organization to be the solution. We need things to be solved, and whatever role we can play is what we will do.
Right on. Fantastic. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, John, for what was a fantastic conversation and another really inspiring episode that, for me at least, pushes a lot of the stereotypes that we think of when it comes to agri-food. I'll acknowledge that I like to take on the role of the agent provocateur. I try to ask questions and kind of push the envelope of discussion to areas that provoke thought, that allow us to not only engage our curiosity, but take on the moral responsibility of finding better ways of doing things. And what I really enjoyed about John's perspective is the way in which he fuses the kind of radical elements that science allows us to entertain with the responsible elements of research and sustainability and enterprise. And that's where, again, I feel that the domain of agri-food affords us a certain privilege when it comes to imagining the future, a kind of empowerment, a kind of collaboration that's rarely seen in other sectors, rarely seen in society as a whole. And it speaks to what we're trying to do here on the Future Herd, which is bring together different perspectives, bring together different elements of Canada's food system so that we can all learn from each other, so that we can become the kind of global superpower, the kind of global force for good that many of us are motivated by, and that, if anything, our chaotic world kind of mandates. So thanks again to John. Thanks again to Jen, who is really turning into a fantastic co-host. Jen, of course, deserves credit for producing today's episode. And we've got a great set of panels coming up that I think will further augment what we're doing here on The Future Herd. So thanks again. If you're enjoying the show, give us a rating, share it with your friends, and we'll see you soon for another episode of The Future Herd.